a Therapeutic Thursday. We're joined by Pastor Robbie Pruitt from Ashburn, Virginia. Pastor, something else entirely, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. I don't quite know what that is. Good to be with you, Jim and
like,
David.
Be like a very young pastor would be a pasty, I think.
It's a mixture of turnips and potatoes and vegetables cooked in a puff pastry.
Eastern European delicacy there, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very popular up in the northern Minnesota Iron Range.
As a matter of fact, did you know, David, they're used for communion in the Anglican Church, too, so which is really very nice. Yeah.
That'd be a good reason to join just by itself.
It's not nice to poke fun at the Anglicans. I'll stop that right now. Robbie is a...
No, man, it's turning into an Anglican roast.
Church in Fairfax, Virginia. He's also the executive director of Preserving Bible Times, so we value him on a number of counts here, and he joins us just about every Thursday. We learn a lot, and we've been wending our way through Luke for some time here, and each time, I'm afraid, Robbie, you give me the general topic, and I say, well, wait a minute, let's go back and there's so many things, so many questions that I have. Luke is just packed full of information that is, okay, I'll say it, almost useless without the context. I mean, you got to have the context to see what he's getting at with these things. And when you don't, you're just missing like two-thirds of the topic. We're into Luke 20 today, and this is chock full of stuff. And I'm not. You mentioned the resurrection, and there's marriage involved, and he finds himself in the heart of the action on teaching on the temple courts as we start Luke 20. And then they start to get the Pharisees gang up on him a little bit, and he handles them superbly as he always does. Tell us about that, and anywhere else in Luke 20 or 19 or 18 where you'd like to go, Robbie.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right about the way that Jesus so skillfully handles the religious leaders as his authority is questioned.
You know, what we're missing is the body language. Does he frown? Does he wink? Right. Does he smile? Does he point at them? I wish I had that context. That's just unrecoverable, though.
Right. There's really no way to know. I was listening to Chuck Missler do a lecture about how he thought he knew Jesus smiled. And he said, have you ever seen little children run to someone who did not smile? And his thesis was, of course, Jesus was happy and smiled, or the little children wouldn't feel that he was approachable, which I thought was good conjecture, but we really don't know. I mean, we really don't know about the body language unless the scriptures tell us plainly.
Mm-hmm. I would venture a bit that he got down on his knee, too, for the little ones, to look them right in the eye.
Right. Yeah, I would assume that, too. But sometimes we do get clues, like he went away sorrowful. We can kind of picture the body language in our mind when we hear some of this. But Jesus' authority is being questioned throughout 20, and he handles them well, but I would argue that he handles the opposition well throughout the chapter and is teaching and confronting the religious leaders, especially the scribes and the Pharisees. And specifically, when we look at the parable of the wicked tenants, which you wanted to, we can look at a little bit today like, but...
Yeah.
Jesus is teaching the people in the temple and preaching the gospel, and the chief priests and the scribes with the elders came up. So we know three categories of
people. He's surrounded by people who want to hear what he has to say. They know him by reputation. Maybe they've been following him for days down from Galilee or wherever he arrived from. And I envision the Pharisees kind of pushing their way to the front to exert their authority in their sphere of influence, the temple.
Yeah, it's the difference between listening in to desire to hear what someone has to say versus listening in to see how you can trap someone in what they're saying. And it's definitely the latter here with the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders. And later we'll see the Sadducees come into the picture. So immediately you have to ask, well, what is a chief priest? What's a scribe and what's an elder and what's a Sadducee? To understand kind of the bent on their approach of trying to catch Jesus. Because we all have our niche, and the Sadducees' niche is they don't believe in the resurrection. The joke goes, which is why they are sad, you see. And that's...
don't use that one anymore, Robbie.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's... It's the Bible teacher jokes. They just kind of flow from me naturally. But I love what Doug used to say when he looked at the passage. He says, we see what we know, but we don't always know what we see. Hmm. And so when we're looking at the biblical context, we're trying to see what we don't see. We're trying to ask passages, questions of these passages, and to get to the bottom of what we're reading here.
Sometimes Jesus gives us clues, though, and you mentioned, how do you know Jesus smiled? I'm thinking of the parable of the midnight visitor and asking for bread. It was Doug's feeling that was such a ludicrous proposition to the disciples, because Jesus was teaching, he was in the midst of teaching them how to pray, that they would have laughed. They would have recognized that as an absurd situation, couldn't possibly happen, and it's almost as if he shared a joke with them to make the point about prayer. So I think sometimes we can get a hint of what the physical, the body language was like, but it's assuming, and so much of context is assuming based upon study and understanding and knowledge of the culture. It's dangerous sometimes just to make an assumption on your own recognizance, so to speak, there.
Exactly. I mean, that account is very much tongue-in-cheek, but I love to read through the scriptures with the idea that I'm going to learn the culture and ask questions and see where the culture comes out. Let me give you an example. Verse 2 of chapter 20. And they said to him, tell us by what authority you do these things, or who it is that gave you this authority. So several things we can grasp from this. We know they're on the Temple Mount. We know that Jesus is teaching, which is assuming a position of authority. We know that people of authority have approached him, the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders. I would argue that this is these three positions are varying degrees of authority, and their concern is who gave Jesus his authority to teach. So you can make some assumptions here, which can be validated by some research, that authority and hierarchy is important in the culture.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the NIV, it says the chief priests and the teachers of the law together with the elders. So there's distinguishing characteristics between those three groups. I always think of the chief priest, but this is plural, chief priests, must have been the leadership group from the temple hierarchy, I imagine, which could have included the chief priest himself, assistants, others in the office, maybe some Sadducees, because they were the Supreme Court of the country, weren't they? The 70 of the Sadducees. No. I'm the Sanhedrin I'm thinking of. Sadducees were a subgroup of Pharisees with a different set of beliefs, including resurrection. So I take that back. I was mistaken. But the teachers of the law, who were they?
Well, the Levites are certainly teachers of the law, people who understand the law, and people who are teaching the law.
Are they the same as scribes, who were also very influential in the temple?
The scribes are actually recording the law. They're writing it down. So they're scribing the Torah or writing it down. Pharisees are teachers of the law. And Jesus, in a sense, is a Pharisee because he is a teacher of the law. And he is teaching, but the question at hand is who gave you your authority. So, you know, the difference between, you know, a religious leader or a chief priest would be like a high priest, like Caiaphas. When we get to the crucifixion narrative, we hear the line that Caiaphas was the high priest that year. And so we're starting to see that there is a hierarchy, there is an order of power, and you should not be teaching or expounding on ideas, especially not on the Temple Mount, unless you have gotten your authority legitimately.
So this was a valid question they were asking.
Sure.
But wasn't it dangerous that they would ask that in front of another group of people, of the people who were following him to hear him? I mean, they're running some risk here.
They are. And Jesus, I mean, the whole risk with Jesus is that he's disrupting everything. And this is why they're approaching him. Keep in mind, we're downshifting here, or, you know, upshifting, depending on how you're looking at it, to the crucifixion. Jesus is concluding his ministry, and he's moving towards the cross. So he is escalating his provocation as well as his visibility, and here is an example of that.
He'd already met Zacchaeus, so this was after he arrived in Jerusalem, coming up from Jericho with other pilgrims for that Passover. So that's right. So this is like Monday, or he arrived on what we call Palm Sunday. So this could have been Monday or Tuesday of that week when he was teaching at the temple.
Mm-hmm. And so the way Jesus addresses the questioning, he says, I'll ask you a question. Now you tell me, the baptism of John, was it from heaven or from man? And if you remember the Gospel of John's account of John the Baptist, even earlier in Luke, that the people of authority are surrounding him even there. They're listening in. They're present. They're seeing the fervor. We're seeing tax collectors coming to John, and you see all the different diverse crowds of people from different backgrounds flocking to John, and we see John's popularity. And so Jesus leverages John's popularity and their knowledge of John the Baptist, and he says, tell me about John's baptism. Was it from heaven or from man? And they know they're in a bind here, and they even say what they're thinking, and we can see this in verse 5. If we say from heaven, he'll say, then why didn't you believe him? But if we say from man, then all the people will stone us. So there's, to your point, Jim, that there's a crowd, and this is risky for the religious leaders. If they say the wrong thing in this moment, they could be stoned to death by this crowd.
Well, here's another factor. The Sanhedrin would have already made the decision at this point to crucify Jesus, the way I see it, and the way the calendar of events of that Passion Week. They may have been anxious to embarrass Jesus in front of his group to lessen the blowback from the crucifixion they were already planning.
Right.
And that's what I was thinking too. I was wondering if it sounds like some of the religious types are already in. I mean, they already see down the road. They already see the next steps that have to take place. And it's easy to imagine that there's a couple of them who have already accepted the notion that these things have to happen next.
Yes, they're trying to publicly make their case. They're trying to make it public. Right.
They may have been trying to create a situation where they could arrest him.
Absolutely.
And he foiled this entirely here.
Right, and with this verse, I mean, with these opening verses, because Jesus flips the script on them and asks them the question. I'm going to answer your question for you. You ask by what authority I do these things. I'm going to answer it. But first, I want you to tell me by what authority John's baptism was. And they don't want to give the answer. Because if they say from heaven, then everything's legitimate and it's validating Jesus's ministry. If they say from somewhere else, from the netherworld, if they say it's from earth or from man or from the enemy, then they're going to stone the religious leaders to death.
Here's another fine point. When they talk about John's baptism, are they talking about generically what he was doing with his followers and disciples, or were they talking about his baptism of Jesus specifically? Could have been either way, or both.
Yeah, they're speaking of his baptism in general, because this was going on for quite some time before Jesus gets there. And then Luke's unique in his gospel.
His baptism would have been 3 years before at this point.
Right. And John's baptism was going on long before he baptized Jesus. Mm-hmm. And Luke's gospel is unique in that it tells us that the religious leaders are there, but it also tells us that there are tax collectors there, and there are Roman soldiers there. And this really disrupts things when you see a combination of Jew and Gentiles flocking to John the Baptist from the very beginning. And so Luke's gospel is unique in this account because everyone's asking, what shall I do? What shall I do? And there's a teaching from John about what they should do differently now that they're baptized. But John the Baptist is the forerunner preparing the way for the Messiah. So if his baptism is from heaven, that means that everything else he's saying is correct as well, that he is a voice crying in the wilderness, make straight the pathway of the Lord. His words, behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world, is also legitimate, and he's naming and labeling Jesus as the Messiah.
It also reminds us how important John the Baptist was, because I believe he would have been executed long before in Herod's prison. So this was still an issue of this was a current political hot button in the religious circles in Jerusalem and with the people, apparently.
Right, and even so far as to thinking that John the Baptist had somehow risen from the dead when Jesus is doing these miraculous signs, mm-hmm. they're thinking that somehow John the Baptist has risen from the dead.
Well, Lazarus had just been risen.
Right, and then there's
the
that.
2 weeks.
So
yeah.
John the Baptist had not been risen from the dead, but they think that maybe the miraculous works that Jesus is doing is somehow a resurrected John the Baptist, which is a fascinating little caveat.
This all smacks of desperation on the part of the Pharisees and the temple elite, because they know what's coming up.
Absolutely. And so the parable of the wicked tenant follows on the heels of this setup in 20. So they answered to Jesus' question that they did not know where John the Baptist's baptism came from. And Jesus basically said, neither will I tell you what authority I do these things. By the way, Jesus' authority is his own authority because he's God. And so he's holding this back, and he's trapped them in their words publicly. So now publicly they can't arrest him in this moment. And he continues his teaching, the parable of the wicked tenants, about the man who planted the vineyard. And he landed out the tenants and went into another country for a while. And while he came, he sent a servant to the tenants so that they would give him some of the fruit. But the tenants beat the servant and sent them away empty-handed. He sent another servant, but they beat him and treated him shamefully, sent him away empty-handed. And he sent a third, and they wounded him and cast him out. The owner of the vineyard said, what shall we do? I will send my beloved son. Perhaps they will respect him. And when the tenants saw him, they said to themselves, this is the heir. Let us kill him so that we may inherit the vineyard, that the inheritance will be ours, the text says. And they threw him out of the vineyard and they killed him. What then will the owner of the vineyard do? The father of the son they just killed, in other words. He will come and destroy these tenants and give the vineyard to others. When they heard this, they said, surely not. And he looked directly at them. And here's an example of body language. We can see clearly from the text what the body language looks like. He looked directly at them and said, what then is written? The stone that the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone. Everyone who falls on that stone will be broken into pieces. And when it falls on anyone, it will crush him.
At that point, the Pharisees, the chief priests, the teachers of the law, the elders, had to be quaking in their boots.
Exactly, because here, I would argue that this parable of the wicked tenants actually unpacks Jesus' authority as the Son. He is, in effect, saying, neither will I tell you what authority that I do these things. Now let me tell you a story. And he tells the parable, which implicates the religious leaders, has him as the son, the rightful heir, and has them as the wicked tenants who beat and kill. He's foreshadowing the cross to come. He's telling them what they're about to do, because they do not want God. They want God's inheritance. They want God's vineyard. They don't believe that God is coming back. They don't believe that the vineyard owner is coming back. They believe that the vineyard owner is dead, and if they kill his son, they will be able to lay claim to the vineyard.
Now, here's another rabbit trail, and I've been thinking about this, you know, just today. Is John the Baptist still alive during this period?
At this moment, no.
At this moment, he's already been killed.
That's right.
So, I'm just wondering if there was some form of collusion that maybe if we kill John the Baptist, this will keep him, this will knock him off his route, off his Jesus has got this momentum building up, and then John the Baptist gets killed.
That it would derail Jesus' ministry, you're saying?
Yeah, right. I mean, I'm just wondering if there was some connection between Herod and Herod's granddaughter or daughter-in-law, or in the dancing and all the rest of that business, because it seems like it's a little bit too coincidental that that's one of the first things that happens. You behead the guy who is in the same that's on the same path, but right, supporting Jesus. And maybe this is just my spy fiction.
I think others have interpreted this similarly. In watching The Chosen, there was a scene, and again, this is, I think it's made up, although it's plausible, that Nicodemus actually visited John in prison to see who he was.
Huh.
Nicodemus was kind of in the middle in this, and came out with a great deal of sympathy for John, but he couldn't save him. So I guess the question remains, did the Pharisees direct the execution of John the Baptist? I don't know that there's any way we can ever know that, but it's an intriguing question. Because we use this insult to Herod and his marriage and so forth. Mm-hmm. It seems, I'm not sure that Herod was that trivial, although he was unbalanced. He was unstable, and who knows what might have set him off. Robbie?
Well, he was tricked into doing it. I mean, it was his wife that wanted the head of John the Baptist on the platter. And just to give you a chronological context here, Luke 9, 7 through 9 is the Lucan reference of John the Baptist being beheaded. We also have Matthew 14, if you're looking in Matthew's gospel, for the chronology. And in Mark's gospel, it's Mark chapter 6. So it doesn't occur in John's gospel, John the Baptist's beheading. But you see from Luke 9, we're talking in where we are today, we're talking 11 chapters ago.
It was always Doug's position that Luke tends to be more chronological than the other gospel writers. You agree with that?
Yeah, I agree with that. Mm-hmm. And it's an orderly account. He literally puts it in order chronologically, but also orderly. And the reference about Herod thinking that Jesus was John the Baptist, and this is probably his paranoia. He believes that Jesus is John the Baptist resurrected. Matthew 14:1. It says that at that time Herod the Tetrarch heard the fame of Jesus, and he said unto his servants, "This is John the Baptist. He is risen from the dead, and therefore mighty works do show forth themselves in him."
Well, when Jesus asked his disciples, and I think this was at Caesarea Philippi there, "Who do people say I am?"
Yeah,
that's the question. Some said he's John the Baptist or Elijah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. That question is not, that question is being asked by everyone for different reasons.
Hmm. And that's a factor that doesn't often come up. And again, the chronology in Luke is just astounding, because if you don't understand that Jesus is teaching in the temple during that week, during the early part of Passion Week, after the raising of Lazarus, and with the plot already hatched, you know, probably sentence already passed on him by the Sanhedrin, that puts everything into place so quickly. So the chronology is critical here.
We know it from John's gospel. We know that the raising of Lazarus, they set out to kill him. That's John chapter 11. We know from the raising of the man, or the healing of the man at the pool of Bethsaida, that they set out to kill him. Mm-hmm. John chapter 5, that they determine in that moment that they're going to kill him. And then, of course, John's gospel begins early with the triumphal entry. So Jesus is doing everything in his power to set up his death so that he could resurrect.
Boy, this would make a great movie, wouldn't it?
might want to call it The Passion of the Christ.
Well, the passions are what we miss here without knowing that context. I mean, that heats this whole situation up tremendously to boiling. when he refutes the Pharisees, turns them on their heels, and they go to some other way to entrap him. Now they down at the bottom, they send spies to see if they can find some other reason, some way to nail him, and justify the crucifixion they've already planned.
And the beauty of the parable of the wicked tenants is he tells them what they're about to do.
Mm-hmm. In front of his fans, his groupies there.
If you read the crucifixion account and you read the parable of the wicked tenants, I mean, even them dragging him outside the city walls to beat him and crucify him is right here in the parable of the wicked tenants.
Hmm.
That they drag him outside the walls of the vineyard. And so, I mean, Jesus makes this crystal clear, answering the question by what authority he does these things. Hmm. He's doing them because he is his father's son. He is the rightful heir. He has the keys to the vineyard, the keys to the kingdom. And so he's doing this on his own authority.
This is amazing. Mm. You got to weave all the factors together here to really understand the gravity of the situation and the beauty of it at the same time. It's just an astounding. And Robbie, you bring us so much on Luke. It's just made it alive for me, and I'm sure for David.
Yeah.
And hopefully for our listeners as well. Just super. And we appreciate you. We'll hopefully see you next week. Let's see, next week is today's the 3rd. That'd be the 10th. We'll see you next on the Marine Corps birthday.
There you go.
Okay.
Looking forward to it.
Yeah.
See you guys on the 10th. Great to be with you, Jim and David. Thanks for having me on.
Be well, Robbie.
How's the missus doing, by the way? How's the missus doing?
Due date.
Due any day now here.
Any day now.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Maybe number 4 on the way, coming soon.
Cool. All right.
All right. We'll be praying for you.
Indeed. Robbie Pruitt, and I want to mention, too, the Preserving Bible Times website. Preserving Bible Times is preservingbibletimes.org. It's a wealth of information, teachings, some free, some you can buy, e-books and streaming video on the context of the Bible. It helps you understand what's between the lines, just like we've been talking about today with Luke 20. So we suggest you pay them a visit, preservingbibletimes.org. Take care, Robbie. We'll see you. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Robbie.